Just coming up to 9 minutes past 1 o'clock and welcoming back to Radio Jones, I have the excellent Tony Gosling. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Very glad that you could join us today. Now, something that you have been involved in, because you were invited to a commemoration of his life. It's a story which has taken a few headlines in local news in the United Kingdom, but really not as much attention has been put on this incredible gentleman, Harold Wilkinson Golding, as we would wish.
No, because he was truly one of the great heroes of the Second World War. He did more missions over to occupied France and Belgium, around the coast, all around there, than anybody else in the whole of the war. And he was a commander of something called HMS Northney. That was the commando training place down at Hayling Island near Portsmouth. And pretty much the whole of Hayling Island was dotted with these various different training camps during the war, where commandos were trained. And apparently the Nazis were absolutely scared stiff of these people, because they would appear, basically they were usually ferried across by a quiet sort of 50-foot long ship of some sort across to a few miles off the coast, and then they would slip off from the boat in canoes, usually with two men on each canoe. And it obviously, there would be moonless nights, absolutely pitch black, and they would either go paddle down rivers or just make landings during the war. So these were highly trained people, very brave of them to set foot on occupied Europe. And they were doing things like dropping off and picking up agents. They were doing things like sabotage operations, this kind of thing. So the old commando books that I used to read as a kid, a lot of them talked about, you know, the sorts of daring missions that they did. But the real key to why it's taken 70 years to acknowledge the role of Commander Golding is an amazing story, and it's Jill Golding, his granddaughter, that discovered an attaché case in her mother's attic, which contained literally scores of top-secret documents which belonged to her grandfather. Now, she started going through all these, and then she wrote to people like the Ministry of Defence, the Royal Navy, which this all came under, and she was getting really no replies. So she started going up to the Public Records Office in Kew, and it transpired that her grandfather had been really, you know, he'd also got a DSO in the war, and yet, so she was wondering, well, why has he been rubbed out of history? Because all she had was a couple of letters from her previous generation. Anyway, it turns out that one of the last missions that was done by these commandos at the end of the war is described in a book called OPJB, O-P-J-B, by Christopher Crichton, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War. And what it looks like, certainly from, you know, I can't prove this yet, but it's certainly what looks like has been going on here, is that some of these commandos were used for a top secret mission right at the very end of the World War II to go and snatch Martin Bormann, who was the Reichsleiter, Hitler's number two, from Berlin, from under the noses of the Russians, just as they were starting to take over Berlin. And the reason for that was because he had all the keys to all the Nazi gold, most of which was in Switzerland, much of which had also been squirreled away in other parts of the world, like the Philippines, Argentina, etc. And the idea was, this daring mission, then they would get all this loot and share it out amongst the countries that had been looted. And I would imagine that Commander Golding would have been told that as a cover story, because once Bormann was brought back to Britain, as is described in the book, he was then disappeared. And a lot of people were saying, well, hang on a minute, where's all this loot? Why isn't it going to the people who it was stolen by the Nazis from? And it turned out that people had been double-crossed, and that this was going to be basically used by the international mafia after the war. And it looks like it was. So that's a bit of a strange. And I mean, the reason that it's all so close to what we were doing last weekend was that the author of the book, Christopher Crichton, that wasn't his real name, because he was still, I suppose it would have been 55, 60 years after the end of the war, afraid of using his real name because he was worried he'd be arrested under the Official Secrets Act. And if you remember, you know, some of the best novels written after World War II, that is by people like Ian Fleming and Dennis Wheatley. These were people who were involved in top secret operations. Fleming was the commander of this Operation James Bond, Op JB. So they would write about this as fictional books, you see, and then they couldn't be done under the Official Secrets Act. If it was, you know, the things that had really happened were interwoven into fiction. But Christopher Crichton wanted to write his personal account. His real name is John Ainsworth Davis, and John Ainsworth Davis died last year, but he did get to know Jill, who's the granddaughter of Commander Goulding, before he died. And so that's, I think, it's absolutely fascinating. One of the things that John Ainsworth Davis said to Jill was, in a way, it's good that you're grandfather died so soon after the war, because he died unexpectedly, aged 41, just after the end of the war, because he wouldn't have wanted to know that we'd been lied to. So, to my mind, what's been going on here is for 70 years, the establishment has been covering up, effectively, one of the greatest war heroes, because they used scores of his men for this top secret, effectively a mafia mission, which was ordered by Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill, Mountbatten. And in the Op JB book, he's actually got letters from Churchill and Mountbatten to John Ainsworth Davis, attesting to the truth of what he's written in the book. So I would recommend it. It's only about 150 pages. It's a very good read. You know, I'm a big believer in reading books. You know, I don't think necessarily the internet is where you're going to find out stuff, or certainly the television news. And Op JB is a terrific read.
Tell me, what do we know of him dying at the age of 41 in 1945? Was that...
Absolutely nothing. It was a very mysterious, because he was in reasonably good health. He'd been shot a few times, but he was certainly not looking like he was going to die at the end of the Second World War. And he was taken up to Scotland, and I think it was he died of a stroke or something. But certainly there was a sort of rumour, anyway, in the family that, you know, it was some sort of a premature death, and it wasn't necessarily by natural causes. I mean, I suppose you'd expect that during the war, but it certainly wasn't immediately obvious that he died of any kind of injuries, anything like that. So, I mean, as his men were used for this mission, it may simply have been that the establishment thought, well, this guy knows what we did. We don't really want him talking to other military people or the public about what we did with his men at the end of the war. And, you know, there's a lot more corroboration of what John Ainsworth Davis tells us in his book. And that is really, because what we get there is the first side of the Bormann story. We get the, if you want, the East Atlantic, you know, from Germany and through Switzerland to Britain. But then someone else takes up the story, another great book, really interesting. I mean, I find this stuff absolutely fascinating, and if you've got time to read this stuff, it's really enlightening as to what's going on in the world today. The other book is Paul Manning's book. Paul Manning was the CBS news correspondent in the States, in Europe, for the Second World War. So everybody in America who was following the progress of the war in Europe in the 1930s and 40s would have known Paul Manning's voice very well. And Paul wrote a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which is available free on the internet, you know, if you're into that sort of thing. But you can buy the book as well, which came out in about 1980. And he takes up the story of Bormann's arrival in South America. And his job there was basically as a bureaucrat to set up 750 corporations around the world, mostly in Europe, but in all parts of the world. And in those companies, he would invest the laundered money from loot from the Second World War, and also SS personnel who basically just taken off their Nazi uniforms and strolled into the boardroom. And Paul really describes what some of those companies did in the book that he wrote in 1980, called this other book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. So a lot of this stuff was being discussed by myself and 300 veterans at the weekend, as to, you know, of course, Ian Fleming's involvement, I think, is fascinating, because, you know, his novels, the James Bond novels, in a way, you know, they're hinting back, aren't they? Because a lot of the devious stuff that you see in the novels and in the films, of course, is hinting back to the sort of atrocities and, you know, evil that was going on in the Second World War. But also the name James Bond certainly looks as if he was there referring back to this mission right at the very end of the war, as using the name of the mission, James Bond, as the mission for the character in his books that he wrote in the 1950s.
Stranger than fiction, as they say. Tell me, you went to Hailing Island at the weekend, this last weekend gone.
Yeah, beautiful weather. It's funny, you know, as we were driving down there last Thursday, I think it was, they were forecasting rain. When we got up on the Friday for this mission, it was beautiful, clear blue skies. Absolutely fantastic day last Friday.
And what, I read here that there was a flotilla of motor torpedo boats and a vintage airplane flypast, which was held to commemorate Commander Harold Wilkinson Goulding.
Well, that's right, because he was actually the first, he flew the first German surrender documents back to Britain at the end of April 1945 in a Dakota. So we had a Dakota flypast. And there was also, I think they're called a harbour protection vessel called the Medusa, and these cockle canoes as part of the flotilla. So anyway, it was a fantastic event. It would have been nice to see it covered a bit more in the national press.
Who organised it, Tony? Who instigated this commemoration of him?
Well, it was really organised by Jill, who's been just as dogged as her granddad was, I think, in tracing down the truth, the facts behind what happened in the war, and also the British Blue Plaque Society, who put these blue plaques up around Hailing Island, one at HMS Northney, which is where the headquarters was of the Royal Navy, and what they called the Special Boat Unit, which is where the SBS was first formed. It's the sort of naval equivalent of the SAS. And another one at the home where he lived on Hailing. And, of course, his granddaughter is still living down there, runs a lovely B&B.
Now, as you've described, she came across boxes of documents, stashes of documents marked most secret or top secret.
That's
in
right.
The attic of her parents.
Well, when I met her first at the end of last year, we recorded an interview here and broadcast it here in Bristol with her. But she was quite nervous about these top secret documents, about whether someone was going to take them off of her, you know. So she had several copies made, and, you know, she was being very sensible about it. So if the authorities, Ministry of Defence or whatever, decided, right, we don't want her having those, she had several stashes of copies of them elsewhere, you know. So she'd taken a lot of precautions, and I don't think she, I mean, because you know, is anybody would expect that sort of reaction if you've written politely to the MOD, to the Royal Navy, asking for details about your relative and been told, well, we can't tell you anything, you know. So she wasn't quite sure what was being hushed up, and I think slowly it's dawning on people that there was some nefarious activities carried out not by her grandfather, but by people using the men her grandfather had trained. Those people effectively being Winston Churchill, the King, would have signed this off too. Ian Fleming, although I think after the war he thought the better of what he'd done, and he tried to let us know as much as possible about the things they'd got up to. But the key figure in all of this is a chap called Desmond Morton, Major Desmond Morton. He ran something called M-Section, MI6, which was basically Churchill's own private part of MI6, which he used for his own private operations during the Second World War. And in the James Bond novels, there's a chap called M in the novels. That's supposed to be, anyway, refers to M for Morton, for Desmond Morton. And he lived very, very close to Churchill down in Kent. Churchill bought his house, Chartwell, which is well worth a visit if anyone's back in Kent. It's run by the National Trust now. But the interesting thing about that is that Winston Churchill bought Chartwell after Desmond Morton bought his place just down the road in Crockham Hill. So Morton lived about a mile away, and Churchill bought Chartwell to be near him. So who was really running the war?
Tell me, you mentioned that about 300 people turned up at the event. And you mentioned earlier veterans, so there were people there who lived through what we're talking
about. That's right, yeah.
You got to speak to those people.
Oh, yes, very, yeah. And I think there's a definite feeling amongst a lot of these I suppose you'd call them British Legion types, really, people that regret the British Legion. A lot of them were wearing medals, this kind of thing. A very kind of anti-EU feeling, a love of Europe, a love of Europeans, but a real dislike of Brussels and the kind of bureaucracy that goes with it. And, you know, I think that we, you know, a lot of us will point to Westminster and say, well, that's not much better. But they do, I think, almost all of them feel rather betrayed by this embracing of the whole kind of EU mechanism. Now, you know, effectively, the EU is the Brussels-based EU is a kind of corporate government, really. I mean, it's big corporations that frame our laws now, the ones that come from the EU. And, I mean, I've seen evidence of this myself, where you see, for example, one of the big construction companies will formulate some plans for highways that should go around Europe. Mm. They'll put together a kind of dossier presentation with their own logo on it, and then you'll see this come out from the European Commission with nothing changed apart from the logo. It's now got an EU Commission logo on it. And that's the way a lot of our world is going. It's a kind of corporate oligarchy, really, with a handful of super rich people running things. I mean, as you've probably just seen in the honours, the people who have been taken to the onto the House of Lords, many of them are simply massive donations, given large donations to political parties, particularly the Conservative Party. And that's not the way to run society. You know, you should be giving those honours to people who've actually done something for the public rather than just for a political party.
Well, that's true, Tony, but we see this more and more, and yet people feel powerless to be able to do anything to change this. I mean, particularly poignant when you mentioned those individuals who feel betrayed, having fought through a war such as the war that we're speaking about, and to feel betrayed. That's even worse than somebody like you or I, who've had the advantage of never having to live in a war situation.
Well, yeah, but they're not bitter. This is the interesting thing. They've sort of got a bit of a twinkle in their eye, almost as if they've got something up their sleeve, you know. We're not going to. One of the veterans said to me, "Well, we've won two world wars against the powers on the continent. Do you think we're going to lose the third one?" And this sort of twinkle in their eye they've got, you know, it's just quite nice. I mean, maybe they know something I don't, but...
Well, I've seen this with, you know, older people that I've been privileged to be, you know, very, very social with or intimate with, you know, people I've been close to. And very much I've seen an attitude, certainly with my grandparents who are dead now, but, you know, a little bit. And you know, my grandfather fought in the Second World War. And a little bit of, you know what... This is a mess, and I'm not going to be around to see it get worse. And a little bit of sort of pleasure, well, not pleasure, but relief at the fact that, you know, they don't have to witness any more of the way this world is going.
Well, I think, yes, and the big turning point was, of course, 1973. I think it was the 1st of January, where the Prime Minister, Edward Heath, signed us into the EEC. Now, that was a vote, a referendum, and Britain said yes to the European Economic Community, but we've never had the chance to say yes to the European Union, which is, you know, a political union,
yeah,
an economic union. And, you know, we don't have the euro in Britain, but we are definitely going to be affected if there's problems in the eurozone, because we're so connected to the European banks. So effectively what's happened is you've got a different type of takeover going on. You've not got tanks, you've not got men with machine guns coming to the door. What you've got is big corporations taking over financially, a financial empire. And I mean, obviously they do have guns and they do have tanks down in the Middle East and various other parts of the world where there's conflicts going on, but the takeover is exactly the same in a way. You know, if someone has taken ownership, say, of your business, of your home, of the infrastructure of your city. I mean, this is happening now in Greece, isn't it? They're having to hand over vast amounts of Greek infrastructure to the Germans, effectively. And the Germans are the powerhouse of Europe. They've done extremely well out of the euro. The benefits that have come to Germany are pretty much equivalent to the disbenefits that have come to the other countries in the eurozone because of this fixed exchange rate in these different countries now. If you're not so competitive, you can't devalue anymore. It's a real simple economic thing. So effectively, Germany has become incredibly powerful around the world. And the other thing which is a bit worrying is the way that the Germans have been supplying these submarines, some of them for free, to the Israelis. You know, the Israelis are a nuclear power. They've also been using this base Ramstein in Germany as the hub of the drone assassination program. So I think, you know, certain fingers now, particularly after this latest Greek episode, are turning back to Germany and pointing the finger and saying, hey, guys, what are you up to?
And yeah, what do you make of Germany being the, you know, heads and shoulders above the rest of the countries in terms of their welcoming of refugees, would-be refugees and migrants? You know, look at Germany, they're doing their bit. What about everybody else? What do you make of that, Tony?
Well, I think they are doing a good job, actually. And, of course, they're in a position. Look, let's look around Europe at where the jobs are. In Britain, we're being told, we just had the horrific statistic yesterday of 4,000 people within 6 weeks of being diagnosed as fit for work dying. So we've got this horrific situation now where people who are about to die are being told, we're taking away your sickness benefits and you're going to have to go and find a job. So there aren't the jobs. And then there's more statistics of even more migrants coming to Britain, and there simply aren't the jobs here. And those that are in the jobs are being threatened and bullied by bosses saying, well, there's a whole queue of people that want your job, so you better work extra hours, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So there's also, just to add insult to injury, last week, Ian Duncan-Smith, the Tories, announced that they were going to get 1 million disabled people into work. In other words, they were going to start badgering them, taking away their benefits if they didn't get a job. This is absolutely unacceptable in the seventh richest country in the world, and we're starting to see this kind of bullying attitude. I think if you go back to the decades immediately after World War II, partly due to the efforts of people like Harold Golding and many others of defeating the Nazi menace, we had decades away from the control of an oligarchy. I mean, we'd had one in the run-up to World War II. You know, we'd had mass unemployment here, although some people were quite wealthy, a terrible division between rich and poor. And that same thing is seems to be opening up now again. So in a way, World War II and the decades after it, up until the 70s and 80s, were a kind of a respite. Now what we're seeing is the normal oligarchy kicking in with the rich ruling it over the rest of us.
They are indeed. Tony Gosling, we're out of time. Always a pleasure. I hope that we can speak again very soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Pippa.
Bye-bye.